One researcher finds a job that even a robot won't do. Lindsay Turrentine from CNET tells us what to expect in the smart home department of CES. A new device that tells you when your kids wander off, Spectre and Meltdown, what you need to know, and Amazon inside your mirror. All that and more on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 13, recorded on Thursday, January 4th, 2018.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where we resolve to do better.
In 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond.
I don't know what we're going to do beyond 2018, but just in 2018, we're going to do better reporting the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. We've got some important news throughout the show, especially later if you've heard anything about all this Intel stuff that's happening. We'll get to that a little bit later. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the gig economy. We've seen a big shift in the way many people think about what it's like to, quote, work for money as the gig economy has continued to shape itself in the marketplace. In some ways, this kind of gig work can be liberating, but it can also be, well, not really worth the time and effort. Joining us is Daniel Carter, a researcher who wrote about what he called the very bottom of the barrel of gig work. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, thanks.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So you wrote about CrowdTap. It was late last year you wrote an article about CrowdTap. And it's obvious you were very optimistic about what it means for the gig economy. Talk a bit about what that service is and your concerns for how it's doing business with its users.
Sure. So CrowdTap is a company that works as an intermediary between brands and consumers. So people will join CrowdTap, become CrowdTappers, and they complete missions like completing a survey or tweeting out something about a product. They get points. They eventually earn gift cards, things like that. CrowdTap's value to brands is kind of works in a couple ways. Part of it is consumer research, where they're kind of finding out, oh, what do people think about this new flavor of chip, this new packaging? And part of it is more marketing related, where they actually are interested in spreading messages about these products. And so, one of the things that does bother me a little bit about CrowdTap is that it doesn't necessarily sell itself as work, right? So we're talking about the gig economy, but CrowdTap, I don't think would be quick to call itself a gig economy platform. They say that CrowdTappers are sharing their opinions, creating content, connecting with brands. But at the same time, if you go through and read their terms of service, they make it very clear that CrowdTappers are independent contractors, and that's the same employment status that, say, people working for Uber have and all of these other gig platforms. And so by kind of looking at CrowdTap as a form of work, I think it opens up ways to ask things like, oh, well, how much are people working and how much are they making? And when I ask people this, the numbers are I think a little surprising in that people are working a lot for this this platform and similar platforms, 10, 15, 20, 30 hours a week, right? And that starts to look a lot like a job. And then you ask, well, what are they making? And they're actually making very little, a couple dollars an hour, a few dollars an hour. So I think, that's one of the things that I want to talk about. And I think that's concerning about CrowdTap and some of these other platforms. The other thing that the other point I make in the article is just that I don't know how transparent CrowdTap is being about the value that they're providing to brands, they say that people are marketing products to their friends and their family, or that they're sharing their opinions with brands. And they don't necessarily talk about the extent to which brands are paying in order to educate consumers or to, just have a captive audience to teach about their products. I think that's a little buried, and a lot of these lines are blurry.
So one of the things you said is that it sounds like just a normal social media marketing plan or, company, but then it's something different, that some of these people are just opening garbage accounts to do this work there, and they don't have very many followers, and that it's not even really a requirement to do the social media part at all. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's this really weird thing going on, I think, you know, beyond CrowdTap, where the idea of being an influencer has become a thing on the internet. And we understand kind of what that is. And a lot of people aspire to that. And CrowdTap will actually talk about its members as influencers. But, you know, I looked at these people's Twitter accounts, and this is actually how I got interested in CrowdTap, was seeing tweets from these people. And they don't have lots of followers, right? We think of an influencer as somebody who has a large social media following. These people don't. They also, yes, use fake Twitter accounts, or, you know, Twitter accounts that they don't necessarily use for anything else, because what these brands want is for people to tweet out a lot about their products or use their hashtags a lot. So you have this really strange situation where, you know, it does look like social media marketing, and it does look like putting this message out there. But then you ask, you know, where's the message actually going? Who's seeing it? You know, who cares? What impact is it having? And that's when things get really strange.
Yeah, from an influencer perspective, if there aren't a whole lot of followers, no one's seeing those tweets necessarily immediately, but that's where the hashtag kind of comes in. And if you ever go onto Twitter and you put in a hashtag, or you see someone do a hashtag and you're curious about it, you click on it, then you see this endless stream of just tons of people on the same topic. That's kind of what a hashtag is all about. But I wonder if that's kind of the point, right? Is like, oh, you've piqued my curiosity. I dive in there and then I see all of these people. You know, meanwhile, they're making money on the side, not very much from what you mentioned. You also have been looking into a service called Clever, which brands itself as an influencer marketing agency. And that just kind of, when I hear influencer, I end up kind of jumping to the celebrity influencer, yeah. You know, the Kardashian on Instagram that decides to tweet out, you know, that she loves this particular kind of coffee or whatever the case may be. Is this like that, but for the rest of us non-Kardashians?
Yeah. So influencer marketing is really interesting because it's the same word, and it gets used for this whole gamut of things, from Kim Kardashian, right, which is definitely influencer marketing, but it looks a lot like celebrity endorsement, which is something that we've had since long before the internet. Then you have kind of a mid-range of influencers, and these are people who have maybe 10,000 followers on Instagram, 20,000. That's kind of the range where you can start being paid, and they'll make you know, a couple hundred dollars for a post, or a lot of times they'll be paid in free product. So you'll get the pair of shoes if you'll do two Instagram posts on it. And then you have things like CrowdTap that also get called influencer marketing. But I think it's, you know, like you said, really obvious that something different is going on, right? The mechanics, the value for the brands are very different there. So Clever, which you mentioned, actually does kind of the middle and the lower end. So they'll have campaigns that, you know, legitimately popular social media users will participate in. And then they'll also kind of support those campaigns with Twitter parties and these other things where they'll do giveaways and sweepstakes in order to get, you know, maybe a couple thousand normal people or less popular people to use the hashtag.
So you say they're probably not making minimum wage. And I mean, are they subject to other regulations, like FTC regulations that say, you know, you have to disclose if you're being paid to to talk about a product on social media?
Yeah. So the FTC regulations around this are really interesting, regardless of whether you're looking at Kim Kardashian or the person with no followers. Yeah, they follow FTC guidelines. They do disclose. They're required in order to, you know, enter the sweepstakes or whatever they're doing to disclose. And, you know, for example, in Twitter parties, they're very big on disclosing. There's lots of, hey, everybody, remember to disclose and tweet right now that you're doing paid promotion, which is really, it's a strange thing to, you know, go to a Twitter party or do this thing that's communal or about communicating with people, but you're also disclosing that you're marketing at the same time.
What is a Twitter party?
I was just about to ask. I think we all need to know what a Twitter party is. You throw that out there.
Going on Twitter is sometimes a party, but
sometimes.
Yeah, it feels like it, right? No, Twitter parties are bizarre. So basically, brands want to get a bunch of people together to talk about one of their products, and they'll have a usually a popular blogger or someone will host it. And basically, they just say, okay, everybody get together at, it's usually in the middle of the day on a weekday. It's almost entirely stay-at-home moms, from what I can tell, who do these things. And all you do is follow a hashtag, and the host, they're getting paid to do this. They'll usually, over the course of an hour, tweet out things about the product, questions to get people excited. A lot of it's product education stuff. Okay, guys, did you know this shampoo has this ingredient in it, and that ingredient does this for your hair? And then they ask questions, and all the people on Twitter answer these questions in kind of these specific formats these people know. And then they have drawings at the end. So it's, again, this weird blend of consumer education and getting numbers for their hashtag, which looks like value for the brands, and kind of all under this guise of we're having fun and we're communicating with each other.
I'm not sure if that's my idea of a party, but I realize it's a terminology, and we'll stick with it. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about seems partially about getting the word out to other people, but really about like almost re-educating or programming the person who is doing it under the guise of making money. Do the people, I know you talk to a number of people that do this sort of stuff for your article on CrowdTap. What is their perspective on all this? Do they feel like they're getting taken advantage of? Do they feel like they're learning a lot of useless information, or do they feel like they benefit from it?
You know, from the people I've talked to, it really varies, actually. So I have talked to people who say, I really like learning about products. I like trying new products. I like this. And then I've talked to others who are pretty clear that they do not care about the work. You know, you talk to some of these people and they actually need what they're earning, right? Like the $5 Amazon gift card that they make is actually helping their household quite a lot. Or they'll say, oh, I got Tylenol. I needed Tylenol. So I think it's a mixed bag. I don't know, you know, that I had a lot of people say, oh, they're like, you know, educating me as a consumer. But, you know, these people know that there are a lot of scams out there. And CrowdTap is actually one of the ones that they kind of look at as not a scam or more reputable, because they will actually get the gift card that they that they're told they're going to get.
Right. We've all seen those like 20 work from home, you know, whatever things. And they are scammy. And so, I mean, you did talk to some of these people. They're often stay-at-home moms. Some of them have disabilities. Some of them have children with disabilities. It's difficult to do other jobs. So what's the answer here? It's the same with Mechanical Turk or even like Uber drivers or Lyft drivers. Like this is sometimes it's a good job for these people. So what can we do about this?
Well, you know, I don't know about a good job. I don't know which of those are you calling good jobs?
Yeah, I guess it is
it's accessible.
Job. It is
to some people, I think a job like this is accessible where other jobs are not possible, depending on their circumstance. At least this they can do, but it doesn't sound like they're making a whole lot of money doing it.
No. And, you know, part of the problem is we don't recognize it as work, right? And they don't necessarily recognize it as work. And when you're not doing work, it's okay to make $3 an hour. Whereas if you are doing work, we have things like minimum wage laws. And regardless whether you're working for Uber or CrowdTap, you're not getting benefits. And when we're talking about people who do have disabilities, who are sick, I think that's a conversation we should have.
Awesome.
Yeah, it sounds like regulation is the answer. I mean, in my opinion, but others will just say, you know, that's the market and, you know, those people have the choice, but it's complicated. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that I wish there were some other classification for workers beyond independent contractors and, you know, full-time employees. It seems like the internet has taken us to a place where we need some other name for people who work in the gig economy, not just a name, but regulation and benefits.
Yeah, all the things that go with a name. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to kind of protect the employees that are doing that. That or universal basic income.
Right.
You know, no big deal. That should be easy, right?
A small change.
Yeah.
but, it, you know, it is the answer. And then the question is, if we have universal basic income, is anyone going to do CrowdTap?
Yeah, right.
Right. Is anyone going to do a Mechanical Turk if we all have a basic income? What else are we going to do with our time? I think that's a more interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Sit on the beach, Drinking margaritas.
Who's bringing you the margarita?
That's true. A drone, an automated, a robot drone that made the drink before delivering it to me. I don't know. Daniel Carter, it was a pleasure talking to you about this. Where do you want people to follow the work that you're doing online? I know you wrote this article for theoutline.com. Is that where most of your printed articles end up?
That's where a lot of it's going right now. I think I see my website at the bottom of the screen. Follow me on Twitter. I usually throw it up there. But yeah, the outline's been my home lately.
Awesome. DanielCarter.github.io if you want to check out his website as well. Daniel, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for having me. Bye. Right.
Take care.
CES, yes. Consumer Electronics Show, is next week, which marks our annual influx of crazy products that may or may not see the light of day. Here to talk about what she expects to see in the internet-connected home department is Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief at CNET Reviews. Welcome to the show, Lindsay.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. It's good to see you. So are there any overall trends in smart home tech that you're seeing from all your CES pitches that are coming in?
Well, so last year was the year of the elephant in everything. Mm-hmm. This year, it's going to be voice assistants in everything. So we're going to see a lot more of the elephant, but a lot more of all the assistants. Cortana, we just saw Cortana show up in a Cortana thermostat. If you were dying to have Cortana in a thermostat, you can do that. We also just got a pitch from GE on Tesla-enabled lights in your ceiling, so you don't actually even need a smart speaker. You just talk to your lights, your light bulbs. I mean, it's going to be a kind of crazy... try everything in every format, voice, and then we'll see what sticks.
I mean, is that I hadn't really considered that until just now, this idea that as the smart home grows around these hubs that we're getting very used to having suddenly, I mean, this was a big holiday season for voice assistants in the home. Do we get to a point to where it's not just smart home devices that connect to the hub, but rather they're all kind of part of the hub? They all have Amazon's voice assistant and Google's voice assistant built in just in themselves and not just connecting to a single place?
Yeah, I actually think we're already there. And in fact, if you kind of most normal people who don't think about this all day like we do, I think don't even really think when you say, oh, well, you're going to need a hub, they kind of glaze over and go, what?
Totally.
And that's why Amazon has sort of won this game so far, because they just said, here's this speaker, it's going to do everything for you. And people don't really think of it as a hub. Now everybody's entering that game, and you will get rid of this idea that you have to buy a specific product in order to participate in smart home. And instead you just buy a product with voice. And who knows, maybe it'll even be your toilet. I don't know. There's crazy stuff coming.
So I feel like this is such a case of just because you can doesn't mean you should. My parents have the Echo Bee 3 smart thermostat in their house that you can control with the Amazon Echo voice services. But it also has that in there, which like you're talking about, which is just ridiculous because, well, first of all, they already have a Google Home and an Amazon Echo. But who needs to ask their thermostat to play music? It sounds horrible. There are terrible speakers in there. And it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I know the exception I think might be is that if you haven't already bought an Echo and you're not as sort of interested in the idea of the assistant, it's kind of a way for Amazon to show you what it can do, make it into your home. So if you were like, I'm not interested in the smart home thing, I don't want a smart speaker, it freaks me out. But then, oh, hey, I could tell my thermostat to tell something else in my house to do something. Right? Like actually just use that functionality to tell your Philips light bulbs to turn on upstairs. Then you start to understand this concept of the connected home. And it's kind of one more way in. And I think you're right. Like, we don't need voice in every other device in our house, but it might be a way for the industry to kind of slowly introduce all kinds of people to the idea.
Yeah, and a part of making this something that's even more ubiquitous and, you know, to open it up to all the people and not just the people who are nerdy about technology is to get rid of this idea that, oh, well, these systems work with these devices and these systems work with these devices. We're really kind of at the point now, thankfully, where it seems like they kind of all figure like they have to work with everything. That's just how they're going to make it going forward is broad compatibility. Do you think that's where we're at?
I think we're inching toward that, but we're still going to end up in a situation where we probably have two or three different platforms working concurrently. And we might not even, as consumers, be tracking, or making a decision, like I'm in on Asana, or I'm in on Cortana, or I'm in on Siri. It may just be like, hey, my garage door works with my phone. My front door works with my phone. My shower works with my
toilet.
And you just kind of like know that you are going to have one of these assistants in your life, and it will probably work with the things that you want, and without even really making an active decision about it. And I actually think that's almost the entire, that's the way this will happen, because it's so confusing for most people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what about smart home robots? Will I be getting my Rosie, the robot maid from the Jetsons at CES?
No. I don't think so. I mean, sorry. I think that you'll get some cool stuff. I think we'll see. We always see a fun, like last year, you know, beer pong robot. There's always going to be some fun use case. There's going to be somebody who's like, look what this robot can do. And we're seeing a lot of, you know, cool pet tech, and we're seeing things that do very specific jobs. But a do-it-all assistant that does anything you want it to, we just don't have the manual dexterity for that yet. You know, it's kind of like the reality of the Amazon warehouse, where the Kiva robots that stock and unstock the shelves in the warehouse, they actually just drive to the right berth in the warehouse, tell the human standing there what to get off the shelf and put on the robot, and then leave somewhere else. So the human's entire job is just to move your hands, because our hands are better than the robot hand.
Yeah, John Markoff's book about robots was so interesting about that. When you really think about it, like, there's so many things that robots can do 1,000 times better than we can, but like a 2-year-old can reach in their pocket and take out a penny and then, you know, maybe put that penny in their mouth. But like, robots can't do that, you know, and it's really very difficult to do something very simple like that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why, you know, yes, we can get robots that really do a great job washing your floor or dumping, you know, some cat food into the bowl. But that's kind of about it right now.
It's like they can do the macro. They can't do the micro. Mm-hmm. Robots aren't quite at the micro level yet. When I think about what I won't be seeing, because I'm not going to CES, I think about how smart home just as a category has really had a tremendous year, especially, but last couple of years kind of building up to the point where it's at now, where it feels like it's like you say, inching closer to this broad acceptance in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But I also think that probably what we're going to see, or what you're going to see at CES, are a whole lot of items that don't need to be smart. Would you agree? It seems like everybody's going to be cashing in on that regard.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the CES is a great way to get attention. And so you can add something to your brand that gets you a press release at CES and go from there. And I may be jumping ahead to another question that Megan had, but for instance, we're hearing about a hair analyzer that stylists can use to scan your hair and make shampoo recommendations. You know, most stylists probably don't need a machine to tell them what you need for your hair, but it's a great way for this set of salons to get some attention and say, hey, you know, we're part of the Internet of Things revolution. We have an Internet of Things hair analyzer.
I will give them that attention, because it's called the Schwarzkopf Professional Salon Lab. And like, I wondered if it was like involved with like Norman Schwarzkopf. Like, I hope that's what he was doing now. I don't even know if he's still alive, but like, I hope that is what he's doing in his retirement. I don't know why I found that so funny. I shouldn't make fun of anyone's name, but it just made me think of Norman Schwarzkopf.
Anybody can run a chain of hair salons, right?
Yes,
totally. We can all do it.
Yeah, sure. I think it would be a great retirement job, except actually probably really hard. It's probably a lot of work.
Yeah. So that was my favorite. Do you have a favorite from any of the pitches that you've gotten?
I'm still kind of actually cracking up about the GE light bulbs that you can talk to, mm-hmm. That replace your home speaker set. Like the idea of kind of speaking to the ceiling when you want something. It's like asking God.
Yes.
To turn on your lights. This just sort of cracks me up. I think that we're going to see some, maybe not some sort of huge changes, but some incremental stuff that's pretty cool. And this is not exactly smart home, but I am weirdly excited about, there was an announcement of, I believe it was a Belkin brick, you know, a power brick that has AC out. So these things that like, finally, I'll be able to plug my laptop into my power brick. Some really small quality of life changes that I'm excited about right now. I'm sure we're going to see some things like screen technology and you know, really big sea change stuff at CES that we'll hear more about at the show. The early stuff is all about those kind of cool little gadgets that you hadn't thought of yet that take care of one thing.
What about facial recognition? I feel like that's been a big thing this past year, especially with the iPhone 10 making kind of the progress that it's made with the technology. It kind of seems appropriate for that to move into the IoT space a little bit more. Have you heard anything along those lines?
You know, weirdly, no, not yet. Not in the preview content that we've gotten and the pre-briefs. Not a lot of facial recognition yet. I think it's just really hard, and I'm not sure people are demanding it.
Right.
I think, speaking of iPhone 10, though, we're going to see a lot of wireless charging. We've seen that for a few years. I think we'll see now that there are a lot of phones on the market that have that ability. I think we're going to see a lot of aftermarket products to bring wireless charging to the fore, and people might start to actually get excited about that as prices come down and these devices look prettier, and we'll see quite a bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, is CES at all a place where people talk about privacy and security in these Internet of Things or smart home devices? Is that a part of it at all, or are we just too fascinated by our internet connected toilets to care about privacy or security?
I think that it's a place where a lot of people try to avoid talking about it unsuccessfully. You know, everybody wants to talk about their new product. Nobody wants to talk about what might be scary about that product. But people like us, all the journalists there, keep bringing it up. And the reality is that what is kind of ever present with the connected device revolution, if you want to call it that, or smart home, if you want to call that, or Internet of Things, if you want to call it that, is that there are so many more connected devices. So, yes, there are clearly security problems with any connected device, including your laptop, as we have seen in the last couple of days, or including your cell phone. We've always had those worries. What's changing really rapidly here is right now there are 8 billion connected products online in the world, and estimates are there will be 20 billion by 2020. That's a huge opportunity for error and security issues. And so we will keep talking about it, and it will keep being an issue as more and more of these products come online.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lindsay. Lindsay Turrentine is editor-in-chief of CNET Reviews and L. Turrentine on Twitter. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks, Megan. Bye, Jason.
Bye. Great to see you.
And in case you were interested, Norman Schwarzkopf, Stormin Norman, he passed away in 2012. May he rest in peace.
So not involved in a hair salon.
Maybe his relatives are, but he himself is not.
The great hair salon in the sky.
Now, my kids are all teenagers, so we are constantly having an evolving conversation about when and how and why their father and I might want to track them with Find My Friends on their iPhone. But if your children are younger, it's a different conversation. Are we hovering over our kids too much, keeping them too safe, not letting them play like little kids? Our next guest is launching a new product at CES that's designed to let kids act freely in public places but stay wirelessly connected to their parents or caregivers. Welcome, Kim Gavin, founder of Monkey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us what Monkey is.
So Monkey is really just a simple wearable sensor that was created from Bluetooth technology. I used beacon technology and created a silicone mold around it so that you could attach it easily to your child's shoe or other things. And then went ahead and worked with an app developer to develop an app that would allow for fast notifications if the child starts to wander out of the preset boundary that you can customize actually on the app.
So I know from reading your story that you didn't just think today, what kind of app should I create? This was your first app. And tell us what inspired you to create this.
Well, it was actually really a personal experience that inspired Monkey. I was at a birthday party with my youngest child. It was a kind of popular bounce house party that is really common when you're 3, 4, 5 years old. And my husband and I had a close eye on our kids most of the time. But, you know, when we stopped to have conversation with other moms, et cetera, we, you know, for a few seconds became distracted. And we made eyes with each other and said, where is Lila? That's my youngest daughter. And for a second, we just started looking around. And then that second became minutes. And ultimately, she wasn't in the party room anymore. So we had to shut the whole room down. And everyone began frantically looking for her. As it turns out, one of the party room's door was open that wasn't supposed to happen. And she was able to wander off into the lobby. And we found her in the lobby. And it was probably the worst 5 minutes of my motherhood. And I knew from that moment that I had to make something or look for something that would prevent that real, real panic ever again. And so when I started looking, I found things that were expensive and cumbersome. And so I decided, you know what, I'm just going to create something on my own. And that's how I got here.
Yeah, I mean, we're all parents here. I have two children myself. I feel like it's probably pretty safe to say that most parents have been in that situation, right? Where you think you have everything under control, you think you have your kids in view, in sight, and then you turn around and you realize they're not there anymore, and you actually don't know. And you know, it happened to me at a campground where suddenly we looked around and it was getting dark, and my kid was nowhere to be found. We were literally racing against the light. That was gradually going away to find her before it became dark and became a lot more difficult. Obviously, we found her at the playground. But what that reminds me of is that parenting now is very different from when we were all children, right? Like, it's less of a, I hate to use the term, but free range mentality. When I was a kid, I could roam. I could do whatever I wanted in my neighborhood. And, you know, my parents didn't really think twice about that. We knew that our neighborhood was safe and, you know, they felt very confident about that. Is Monkey meant to be kind of like the happy medium there to allow kids to kind of have a little bit more of that freedom, but still give parents that peace of mind?
I think it is. I mean, I think there's the whole technology component too. You know, everybody is using their smartphone in some capacity, a large percentage of the day. So we're connected in that respect. And I think by utilizing, you know, an app-based technology and then just a very simple wearable, we're not being too intrusive. We're adding sort of an extra layer of protection, which was always my intention. It was really just meant to be an early warning. So I think it's not too intrusive, but at the same time, it does something really simple, a very simple premise, and it does it very well. You know, it's effective.
So what it does is as soon as your kid wanders a certain distance, and that distance you can specify depending on how old your kid is or how comfortable you are with them wandering around, and then you get an alert when they are past that?
That's exactly right. And there are certain scenarios that I think parents find more stressful than others. I mean, I find Target to be, with two kids, completely overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm just alone in that planet. I don't know. So there is certain, you know, so you would use like a tight configuration in that setting where you allow the child to go approximately 15 feet is the tight setting. And 15 feet in Target is kind of far. But maybe in a park setting with a younger child or even an older child, or where you have multiple children in play, because this works with multiple kids. So, if you have 2-3 kids and you're in the park, maybe one child is in the tight setting, which is approximately 15 feet, but the other is on the loose setting, which is 230 feet. So that's 230 feet, you know, it's fairly far, but for maybe a 6 or 7 year old in the park, it's not, it's appropriate, in other words.
What about broadening out the technology set? I noticed that something like GPS, which I think in technology circles we commonly, you know, associate with tracking things or tracking ourselves or whatever, our location in the world. There's no GPS involved with Monkey. What was the decision behind that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things behind GPS. GPS makes, it has its setbacks in terms of there's a cost factor. And the cost factor is often, extended to the consumer. And I wanted to make this product very affordable so that, you know, a lot more people could access it. And then the other thing is the complicating factor. I really wanted to keep this simple. When I was designing the product, I got some really good advice from a mentor, and that mentor said there's no such thing as too simple. And the premise on this is really just to be an early sort of proactive warning. If GPS is involved, it's late. The child is lost. And I'm not saying there's not a place for that in a market for it, because there definitely is. But I think from my premise, I wanted something really early and actionable, almost as if the child is still in earshot. But it forces everybody to sort of refocus and get back to the fact that the child is starting to wander. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And GPS is not it would be overkill for that scenario.
For sure.
So I know you founded this company with your twin sister. So I have twins, so I know that was especially difficult because I think a lot of people might criticize this. Well, why aren't you paying attention to your kid? And it's very hard to pay attention to two kids, whether they're and when they're the same age. When it's two, 3 or 4 or 12 year old boys, it's difficult to pay attention to them. So what was your sister's background, and how was that involved in the company?
My sister's always been a women's health nurse practitioner, and her most important role really is to be my twin sister and biggest cheerleader. So when I approached her about the concept, she supported me 100%. And so she went on a lot of my app developer interviews, and she sort of contributed from the mom perspective. She meets moms daily. She delivers babies for a living. And so she's often talking to parents about, you know, some of the challenges they face. And even when a newborn comes home and now you've got a 2, 3, or 4-year-old at home, you know, my kids are 16 months apart. So when we introduced our second daughter, Lila, to the family, Mia was already up and walking around. And my sister found that to be true every time she interviewed a mom, you know, a new mom. It was like, what are your expectations when you go home? Well, it's going to be really hard with 2 or 3 or 4. The feedback was always. So she really helped give me some of that live touch points that that I needed to gather in my gathering phase when I was doing research for the product. So she's been instrumental in that. And then just very supportive, you know, very helpful just in terms of keeping going. You guys interview startups all the time, I'm sure. It's not an easy game to sort of keep going at. And she's been really supportive. So that's her role.
And so it attaches to a sneaker, or you said something else. So like if you were on the beach, you could just like attach it to their bathing suit or something.
Yeah, so the accessory is really threadable. That's why I created the slits on both sides. So if you wanted to, for example, put like a cute pin or a hair accessory, or for boys, you wanted to do like a keychain type scenario, you know, it's a threadable accessory. It just works best with the shoe. But we're going to put some creative ideas on the website about how you can use it outside of the shoe, because I know, you know, that's a question that comes up. When I did the beta testing, I did try, you know, the wrist, and I also tried like a keychain accessory, and inevitably those two universal accessories just never worked really well with both boys and girls. And when we became shoeborn, everybody, the feedback was phenomenal. And so I really stuck with the shoe accessory, but made it sort of versatile enough where you could use it in other things. And again, we'll put some creative case studies on the website to show parents how to do that.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like a piece of technology too, which, you know, sometimes some of these solutions end up being a little too techy. And, you know, when this is something that's going on your kid, like the way it looks, it almost kind of blends into the fabric, blends into the shoe. It almost looks like a special kind of shoelace attachment as opposed to a piece of technology.
It's funny. When I did a lot of the beta testing, none of the kids wanted to give it back to me. I said, no, I don't have that many of them right now. You have to give it back. You know, and I see these little kids today and they say, where's my monkey? And I said, okay, now I have more of them. You can have it back. So it's kid, I call it a kid friendly wearable.
Yeah.
And that's for, you know, for a reason.
So I have to ask you, because on this show we have a rich history with comparing things to Black Mirror for some reason, but it's particularly top of mind because the latest season of Black Mirror episode 2 is called Archangel, and it touches, well, basically the thesis of the episode really touches closely to this kind of genre of technology, the idea that, you know, as parents of the modern age, we really want to use the tools and the technology that we have to stay connected to our children, to protect them, to be safe, for peace of mind and all that kind of stuff. But that it has the potential somewhere down the line of pushing them further away as a result of that, of it feeling like they're constantly under the microscope. But what are your thoughts on that, considering we're kind of in the middle of this maelstrom right now? We're figuring it out as we go.
I don't know. It's hard to say. Our kids are becoming so groomed technologically. I mean, both my children have iTouches. They are so fluent in, you know, Apple technology, in Amazon technology. They're sort of being raised in an era of tech, and all that sort of encompasses. So if surveillance, if tracking, if you know, monitoring is part of that, I don't think that they know, and they can't make a comparison to what it was like before, because it's really all they know. So I'm not too concerned. I think kids are much more welcoming to technology than we ever were in our generation, simply because they're being born into it. You know, there's some exciting technology with baby monitoring it's entering the market. You know, everything from temperature to movement to motion. I think our kids are going to be much more widely accepting of technology than we even probably are today, just simply because they're born into it.
Mm-hmm.
They know no other.
And so what ages would you recommend this for?
I would say that any time the kids, child starts walking is appropriate to put it on their shoe. And then I would say probably up into the age of 8 if you have multiple children. And again, the flexibility there to be able to put one child on a sort of loose setting and another child on a tight setting, I think gives you the ability to have a wide range of age groups that can benefit from it. So I would say probably from the time they're up and walking to the time they're maybe 8 or 9. And really 8 or 9 is because we're probably giving them an iPhone and we're going to be able to track the phone. So it's like the transition into the next, you know, level of being able to find them. Really, that's the age at which you probably could take it off their shoe and put something in their hand. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so what's the cost?
So today it's $39 for a single unit. And then the price goes down as you buy more units. The battery life on the device is approximately 5 months if you never turn the beacon off. So there's some ways to preserve battery life if you turn the beacon off. It is a disposable product, so we aren't rechargeable at this point. We just pop one off and put another one on.
Cool. Well, Kim, thank you so much for joining us. So where you guys are really officially launching at CES, but yep. Can people buy it now and where can they buy it?
Yeah, so you can download the app is for free on iTunes. It's called the Monkey Kids Sensor. And then at www.themonkeyapp.com is where you'll be able to buy the actual sensor. And yeah, I'm shipping today, so feel free to head on over. We'd love to have you.
Right on. Congrats. Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very
much. Really
nice
to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
So if you haven't heard by now, there's some pretty serious news happening, stuff happening with basically most computers on Earth. Meltdown, Spectre, two major flaws they were recently discovered and disclosed that affect Intel, AMD, and ARM processors. And it is no joke at all. In the case of Spectre, researchers say there is no known fix. The only possible way to address it might be to completely redesign the processors, which isn't much of a fix for all those processors that exist out in the real world. And it's a lot of those processors on the real world, to say the least. With Meltdown, a software patch can address the issue, but is said to possibly slow down computers up to 30%. No small performance hit for something that's critical to fix. And this applies to nearly all Intel computers that exist. Around 90% of servers run on Intel chips. So that's a pretty insane number of machines. This is just, I feel like in the past, you know, couple of years especially, but definitely in 2017 and now this, it's just one thing after another with these vulnerabilities. I feel like it's, I don't know, when does it reach the pinnacle? Are we there? Is that kind of what we're seeing right now?
Well, it seems like it's just going to continue. And I think the thing we might reach is just exhaust from thinking about it. Like, that's sort of how I felt about this story. I was like, ugh, I don't even want to think about it. And that's dangerous. That's really dangerous to just get so complacent that you're just like, I don't need to worry about this.
Yeah.
Update if you can. That's the biggest piece of advice. And I mean, a big problem is older operating systems that can't be updated, people continuing to use them for sometimes really good reasons, but they can't update them. And that's a big problem. I think using an ad blocker could also help. It wouldn't hurt to change your password. I was looking into LastPass. They said, you know, go ahead and, you know, they didn't say like that there was anything necessarily, you know, that they had been breached in this, mm-hmm. but it's always a good idea. And I mean, if you use a password manager, change your password for that. It's a good idea to do that every once in a while anyway.
Yeah, because I mean, basically there are all of these, what it does from what I understand about it is it tackles insecure memory to grab information, grab data at the lowest levels, you know, at the kernel level of the computer where as a user, you think it's stored safely, it's inaccessible. There have been demonstrations that I've seen on Twitter where they're basically able to reveal passwords that are just kind of, you know, that as a user, you assume are shaded and protected. And what do you know? There it is. It reveals itself in plain sight. So it's really scary when you consider just the amount of hardware. And it's like almost all computers, essentially.
Yeah, it steals cryptographic keys. I mean, that is what it is. So it's, I mean, someone would have to have malicious intent against you to go and do this. But yeah, it makes sense to change your password.
Well, and now it's all out there. So, you know, anybody that is looking to exploit the vulnerability. You know, they're rushing to do it while companies like Intel are addressing it as they can. Intel says they have plans to release an update to address 90% of the past 5 years worth of processors by the end of next week. That wouldn't address the processors in the wild that are up to 15 years old that are still affected by this. So in some cases, you know, that we're talking, you know, some people are saying, well, you should be replacing these processors. But that's going to happen with the amount of computers that you're talking about here. It's just going to be a whole tailspin. Intel CEO Brian Krzanich also, and this is very interesting, was known to have sold off $24 million worth of Intel stock in November, this after knowing about the vulnerability. Though some were saying that was scheduled, but still very suspect timing.
So they discovered the vulnerability in June, right?
Yeah, discovered it earlier. But I mean, basically what he sold off was down to the minimum that he had to hold on to. So it doesn't look particularly great, but then at the same time, I would imagine Krzanich is smart enough to know that if and when this hit the light of day, that would look suspect. So maybe it's not as bad as it seems as far as that's concerned. But if you want to catch more about this, we were hitting the pavement trying to find some awesome folks to come on and interview on this. But everybody's so busy because this news is still totally breaking right now. So we have a bunch of people that were like, I would love to, but I have to keep writing about this because it's such a big news topic. So if you want to catch a broader discussion on this, you can tomorrow on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Padre and the gang there are going to dive deep into this and give you everything you need to know and ways that you can protect yourself. Just check that out tomorrow on the network on Twyatt.
I'm really surprised that Brian Krzanich didn't respond to my emails.
Yeah, I know. I thought we were going to land a Krzanich interview on probably his biggest day in the hot seat yet. Finally, Amazon has a lot of irons in the fire when it comes to convincing you to buy their stuff. Last year, they went so far as to release the Amazon Echo Look, which is a hands-free camera system that can analyze your outfit to let you know which of your outfits it likes better on you. So then you could stretch that out to the next logical step, and we might end up right where this Amazon patent is, standing in front of a mirror that virtually fits clothes onto our bodies. The mirror and the patent would actually be a mixture of cameras, projectors, and display technology to create an overlay effect so you can see if that shade of red works on you. The patent says it could even transport your image to a virtual location. So you know how that red looks on you when you're standing in front of the Eiffel Tower or on a beach somewhere or something. I could totally see this being a product at some point from Amazon. I don't know at what point, but at some point.
Well, I think they should make it a really dark wood on the outside, and then they could call it Black Mirror.
Ooh, that's a good idea. Actually, and it's totally like you could see an episode writing itself around
the Amazon,
something like this.
Yeah, the Amazon Black Mirror.
The Amazon effect. Mm-hmm. Would you get the Amazon Black Mirror?
That is a good question. I could certainly use it because I have definitely been in the situation where I'll order something online and then it looks horrible on me, or, you know, I just will order something, not order it, maybe it would look great on me. Mm-hmm. And especially standing in front of the Eiffel Tower. Like, I would like to know in case I should go to the Eiffel Tower.
You want to know the right thing to wear when you visit the Eiffel Tower.
But probably not. But I'm not saying never. I never say never. I did not get the Echo look. And I haven't gotten the tiny Echo Spot, which is the one that stares at you while you're sleeping with a giant eyeball. Yes. Although I can find it useful, I haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
Right. I have a little bit of pride.
Well, we'll see. This is definitely one of those future items that, you know, we've kind of long thought would exist someday. And of course, it would be Amazon would be the one that would make it happen. So I totally see it in our Black Mirror future. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us. You can do that at tnw@twit.tv.
Come visit us, but tell us you're coming first, please. Tickets at twit.tv. And if you have to email us from the car on the way here, that's fine. We just need to know. We can't accept walk-ins anymore. So tickets at twit.tv. And subscribe to our show, twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about whether or not I should buy the Amazon Black Mirror, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Jammer B. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Colleen. Megan and everyone else that helps us with this show every week. And thanks to you for checking out the show. This is Tech News Weekly. We'll see you next week on another episode. Bye, everybody.